In 1969, Prime Minister Levi Eshkol was stricken with a heart attack and died. The Labour Party chose Golda Meir to replace him. Golda's emotional reaction to the vote is read from her autobiography by Marion Seldes.
On March 7th, the Central Committee of the Labour Party voted to nominate me as Prime Minister. There were 70 votes in favour, none against, and the Rafi abstained. I've often been asked how I felt at that moment, and I wish I had a poetic answer to that question. I know that tears rolled down my cheeks and that I held my head in my hands when the voting was over. But all that I can recall about my feelings is that I was dazed. I had never planned to be Prime Minister. I had never planned any position, in fact. I had planned to come to Palestine, to go to Mojave, to be active in the labor movement. But the position that I would occupy, that, never. I only knew that now I would have to make decisions every day that would affect the lives of millions of people. And I think perhaps that is the reason that I cried. But there wasn't much time for reflection, and any thoughts I had about the path that had begun in Kiev and had led me to the Prime Minister's office in Jerusalem had to wait. Today, when I can take time for those reflections, I find I have no appetite for them. I became Prime Minister because that is how it was. In the same way that my milkman became the officer in command of an outpost on Mount Hermon. Neither of us had any particular relish for the job, but we both did it as well as we could.
The AFL-CIO had long been a strong supporter of Israel, and it maintained a close relationship with Histadrut and with Golda. The AFL-CIO saw Israel as an island of democracy in the volatile Middle East. Golda spoke before the AFL-CIO in 1969. In a dramatic plea for peace, she appealed not only as a prime minister, but as a mother herself, to the mothers of Arab children to ask their leaders to stop the bloodshed.
And I believe in this as sincerely as I believe in ourselves. The day must come when there will be real peace between us and the Arabs. I've said over and over again, I do not believe, I refuse to believe, that Egyptian mothers in the Nile Valley give birth to their children and have for them this great, glorious ideal that when their boy reaches the age of 18 or 17 or 19, he will go off to war to fight the Israelis, and who knows whether he will come back. But maybe he will be very successful in killing the son of a Jewish mother in Israel. I do not believe that this is what Egyptian mothers are giving birth to their children for. I don't believe that Egyptian and Syrian and Iraqian and Jordanian mothers are prepared to see their infants die because of lack of food and of lack of sanitation, of lack of medical care, just for the great future that lies before them. Maybe they will finally succeed in killing the children of Israeli mothers. I refuse to believe it. And once their leaders realize this, and once the masses among the Arab people dare to stand up and say to their leaders, there's no glory in having our sons killed. We give birth to them in order that they may be alive. I see a future for friendship, peace, cooperation between our neighbors and ourselves. Israel has sent thousands of men and women to the African continent, Asian continent, Latin American continent, to bring to them the results of our experience, to work with them as brothers, to help them in their development plans. It'll be the great day when we don't have to travel thousands of miles and tens of thousands of miles. We'll step across the border, and the young Jew from this side of the Jordan and his farm will cross the Jordan not with tanks, not with planes, but with tractors and with a hand of friendship as between farmer and farmer, as between human being and human being. Like a dream. Maybe, I'm sure it will come true. But my friends, help us through understanding and supporting our search for real peace. And understand us when we say at this time, nobody can produce it for us and our Arab neighbors. Our Arab neighbors and we together, and only we and our Arab neighbors around the negotiating table, equally interested in peace, will perform that which seems like a miracle, signing a real peace agreement.
Peace, the dream that seemed so impossible throughout her life. Time and again she called on Arab leaders to join in negotiations as the only way to attain peace in the Middle East. Nasser died in September 1970, and Anwar Sadat became the president of Egypt. Her first impression of Sadat was that he might be more reasonable and might seriously consider the benefits of peace. She always used to say that peace will come when there will be an Egyptian leader who would like the children of Egypt more than he hates the children of Israel. In 1970, she addressed the UN General Assembly to make yet another attempt to open the peace process.
In an atmosphere in which a callous breach of faith between nations is touted as a virtue, and aggression against a peaceful neighbor is acclaimed as a sacred cause, no hope for peace can prosper. Yet, despite what has happened, we in Israel still trust that for the sake of all our peoples, the Arab leadership will join with us one day in guiding our area from present turmoil to the horizons of peace. I therefore call from this rostrum once again, in the presence of the representatives of the entire community of nations, upon the leaders of the Arab nations of the Middle East, and especially now upon the new leadership of Egypt, to recognize once and for all that the future of the Middle East lies in peace, and this must be achieved by Israelis and Arabs themselves. It will only be achieved by the building of faith and not the breach of faith, by honoring commitments solemnly undertaken and not by undermining them, by negotiation and not by evasion, by talking to each other and not at each other. In short, by the confrontation of peace and not of war. It has been the fate of my country that peace has been denied us by our neighbors since the very emergence of Israel. But has Israel alone been the sufferer? No. All those around us, as well as Israel, have paid the terrible price of endless warfare. Billions of dollars have been spent on armaments instead of on war against poverty, disease, and ignorance. There are now deserts of death where there could be blooming fields. Mr. President, I say this today not in rancor, but in sorrow. I am convinced that all of us in the Middle East will continue to exist as sovereign states. None of us will leave. But we may choose whether we will continue in the sterile course of mutual destruction, whether we will go on hurting each other to no one's benefit, or whether we will venture in a constructive course and build our lands separately and together. For each of us to attain the best for his people, cooperation with his neighbors in the solution of regional problems is essential. Our borders not only separate us, but they are bridges between us. No people is an island. We are bound to each other by the problems of our region, our world. We can make of these ties a curse or a blessing. Each nation, each land must decide. Thank you, Mr. President.
Golda was incredibly human. Even though she served millions of people through her work in various organizations and government service, she would not ignore an individual's problem. Golda's sister, Clara Stern, recalls an experience from Golda's busy days as prime minister. This incident also displays a remarkably humble use of her power.
One of the things that impresses me about Golda and impressed me very much every time that I had occasion to witness it was her deep concern for other people. Many times at the expense of her own health or her own time or strength. And this story about this young girl that worked for her is typical of the sort of thing that Golda would do. She had a girl working for her who had a little baby and had been abandoned by her husband. So she had to move back to her mother's home. It was a large family, and she and the baby had to sleep in a cot in the kitchen. And they kept on going to the public housing and asking for housing, and they kept promising them. And finally, she came back to the house, and she said to Golda in great glee, "I finally have been promised an apartment, and we're moving next week." And Golda and Luca Dar, who was Golda's secretary, planned what they were going to give her, and they were setting aside different things in the house that they were going to give her. And then the day she was supposed to move, Golda came home for lunch, and she found her sitting and crying. And she said, "What's the problem?" She said, "Well," she said, "you know, I came there to get the key, and nobody would talk to me, and they told me the apartment wasn't available." So Golda, instead of eating lunch, went into her office, and she called that department. And the girl answered the phone, the girl answered the telephone, and she said, and Golda said, "Could I speak to Mr. So-and-so?" And the girl said, "He's busy." So Golda said, "Never mind, I'll wait." So she waited a few minutes, and the girl came back on the phone. She said, "The line's still busy." So she said, "Well, never mind, I'll wait." A few minutes more, she came back, and she said, "You know, it's still busy." She said, "Who are you?" So Golda said, "Golda Meir." She said, "Oh, just a minute, I'll get him." So he gets on the phone, and he said, "Oh, Mrs. Meir," he said, what did you want me for?" And Golda said, "When would it be convenient for me to come down and see you?" He said, "Oh, you don't have to come down and see me. I'll be glad to come and see you." And Golda said, "Well, you're a very busy man." This was while she was prime minister. So he said, "Oh, no, I'll come down immediately." So he came down to the house, and Golda called this girl in. And she said to him, "Look, I can understand there are not enough apartments available. I know they're not." But she said, "She's a human being. You promised her an apartment. If for any reason it wasn't available, you should have at least given her the courtesy of explaining to her that it wasn't available." Well, you might be interested to know that within 2 weeks, the girl had an apartment.
Arthur Goldberg, a distinguished American and Golda's friend, comments.
In my various capacities serving our government, I had several occasions to make official visits to Israel. During the same period, Golda Meir was either labor minister, foreign secretary, or prime minister. On all occasions when Mrs. Goldberg and I went to Israel, you know, on behalf of our government, Mrs. Meir always reserved the Sabbath evening of our visits for a private dinner in her modest home in Tel Aviv. This dinner she prepared herself. She was not an avowedly religious person, but she, like myself, placed a high value and premium on Jewish tradition and observance of Jewish holidays. And of course, the Sabbath is the most important of all Jewish holidays. So when we had Sabbath dinner with her, she cooked herself without help and served without help a traditional Sabbath dinner to us, including, of course, the filter fish and all that goes with it. And we recited the traditional Hebraic blessings for the Sabbath.
May the Lord who hears our prayer
his dwelling place above. Bless his people everywhere. Bless them all with peace and love. Oh, say shalom bimromav. Ooh, say shalom aleinu. Ve'al kol Yisrael. Ve'imru. Yase shalom, shalom aleinu ve'al kol Yisrael. 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 Let there be shalom for you and me, shalom. Finally shalom to Israel and the world. Come and sing shalom, bells will ring shalom. God will bring shalom to Israel and the world. Nations of the world, can't you hear our call? Working together, we'll bring shalom to all. Nations of the world, can't you hear our call? Working together, we'll bring shalom to all. Yaseh shalom. Yaseh shalom. Shalom aleinu ve'al kol Yisrael. La 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 la. Yaseh shalom, yaseh shalom. Shalom aleinu ve'al kol Yisrael.
Golda had a vision of the Jewish society that would grow and flourish in the land of Israel. She expressed her hopes to the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith in 1973.
We have to be a Jewish state. Now, when I say a Jewish state, I don't mean that no others can live among us. God forbid. We have a minority of non-Jews now of about 13-14%. And always room for people who are not Jewish. But when I mean say a Jewish state, I mean that vast majority is Jewish, that this is where Jewish culture, Jewish, the Hebrew language, principles of Judaism are carried out and implemented. And for ourselves, I would want this to be a model state in many ways. In the form of society and the justice in the country, and not too great differences between various groups in society of Israel. I like to picture a society where each one really has equal opportunities, and more than equal opportunities, that those that come to us because of the societies in which they have lived, for instance, in backward states, in underdeveloped countries where they've suffered of discrimination, have been held back, that equal opportunities for them is not enough. They have to be given greater opportunities in order to reach a certain cultural level or educational level. I would like a society where it's good to live in for everybody. Not because we want to be a model for other countries, for ourselves, so that within what is called the family of nations, we would be a member of that family, that nobody would be ashamed of us.
Arthur Goldberg comments again.
It was also my great privilege on several occasions to present and introduce devoted my ear to American labor conventions. At these meetings, she spoke in support of the Histadrut, the Israeli labor movement. Her support of the Histadrut is well known. She had been Secretary General. But her unique personality forged a bond between the Histadrut and the American labor movement, which persists to this very day. They are both democratic movements devoted to the same principles. I recall a very special occasion. The Steelworkers Union of America, one of its great unions, was on strike. She sent a special messenger with a substantial contribution to the strike fund. It was the first contribution the Steelworkers Union received for the strike fund from abroad or from American unions. The steelworkers, officials, and rank and file never forgot this, and they had manifested their support and recollection through many years by buying Israeli bonds, by support of Israel, and in other ways. And this recollection and support has also been manifested by the AFL-CIO as a whole.
As the AFL-CIO's Lane Kirkland said,
Golda always wanted to build, not to wage war. She told us that when, as Prime Minister, she addressed our Atlantic City Convention and said,
Why do our neighbors, by their constant conducting of war against us, force our children to shoot and to kill in self-defense? They were not trained and not raised to be warriors. They were not raised in order to defend themselves so that they will have to kill and shoot others. This is the sorrow in the country. This was the sorrow of our victorious army that came back after the war of 67. No rejoicing, no dancing in the street, despite the fact that all Arab leaders in the area announced over and over again for weeks before the war, this time this is the war to end all wars, because after this war there'll be no more of Israel. And our army, our men that have came back, our sons and our grandsons by this time, that have come back from this victorious war where they saved the country and the life of the people, no rejoicing, no dancing, no celebration. We were sad, not only because our sons and grandsons, not all of them came back, but our boys came back with sadness in their heart because they said we had to shoot. We had to shoot at people in order to defend our country and our own people. This we will never forgive our neighbors.